אישור המשטרה. שבוע 31 ברציפות המחאה בקפלן מתקיימת הערב למרות הפיגוע ותחת הבטחה מתוגברת, רבבות כבר שם, נשוב גם לשם. אבל עכשיו במרכז המגזין שלנו הערב, הכאב של הרופאות והרופאים, אלה שעלו לכותרות כמי ששוקלים לעבור למדינות אחרות, אלה ששייכים לקבוצת המחאה חלוקים בלבן, וככה עוד לא שמעתם אותם מסבירים בדמעות כמה הם דואגים למה שיקרה כאן למערכת הבריאות ולמדינה, ולמה הם כבר לא יכולים יותר. רותי שילוני פגשה 15 מהם בשיחה שהפכה להתפרקות של ממש מול המצלמות. הופכים אותנו לאויבים, הם אומרים בכאב.
The caricature of the bloodthirsty Hun was bolstered by a series of fake news reports leaked by the new propaganda industry and disseminated to the public. Among them, the babies in Belgium had had their hands cut off, were being impaled on bayonets, and in one case, nailed to a door. That a Canadian had been crucified by German soldiers, and that dead bodies were being boiled down in so-called corpse factories to be used for ammunitions and pig food. In a foreshadowing of the Freedom Fries incident, sauerkraut was renamed Liberty Cabbage. False atrocity stories would become a staple for nations in wartime throughout the 20th century. The recent example occurred prior to the First Gulf War.
While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
As it turns out, the massacre of babes never occurred. The young girl was actually a member of the Kuwaiti royal family and had been coached by the public relations firm Hill and Knowlton to give persuasive false testimony.
Kids in incubators, and they were thrown out of the incubators so that Kuwait could be systematically dismantled.
The attempt to engender hatred against Germans in support of the war effort was highly successful. But there was another, equally important aspect to the domestic propaganda campaign. If every adventure story needs a villain, it also needs a hero.
Song I made about when they're drafting the men. Uncle Sam say he travel east and travel the west. Uncle Sam say he believe he know the best. Uncle Sam said, you got to put love and go. I'll travel east.
Creel estimated that 72 million copies of 30 different booklets about American ideals were sent across the United States, with millions more sent abroad. In addition to influencing the minds of Europeans, the goal was to redefine for the home population the very concept of what it meant to be American. The new American would not interpret events from what Creel called a class or sectional standpoint, but rather as a unified collective. In this manner, the people could be herded into one white-hot mass instinct. Previously, military action by the United States had been justified under the pretense of maintaining order, protecting American interests, and bringing civilization to the savages. Now, the word civilization would transmute into democracy.
You don't have to hesitate on the sound, see. You got it by love and go. Next number is called 192. I'm Sam Savage, don't come, I'm
going
to talk.
Marshall McLuhan, the Canadian communications theorist, once said that if a fish could talk and you could ask a fish, what's the most obvious element of your environment? The last thing that the fish would say would be water. That's the last thing the fish would notice. And it's true about any culture. Those things that are most powerful and most obvious to an outsider don't get seen by the people swimming in that water. Americans as God's chosen people. This goes back to, as far as back to 1630, where John Winthrop on the Arabella, coming from England to the United States, said, "We're a city on a hill." It's not an accident that in the campaign, you know, debates and stumps of the recent candidates, you had Obama, Barack Obama, actually saying that, "We are a city on a hill," as well as Sarah Palin. Ronald Reagan said it in his inaugural address.
I've spoken of a shining city all my political life, but I don't know if I ever quite communicated what I saw when I said it. But in my mind, it was a tall, proud city built on rocks stronger than oceans, windswept, God-blessed, and teeming with people of all kinds, living in harmony and peace.
We're a city on a hill. And so our mission is to democratize the rest of the world. We've got the best system possible. And basically, people ought to pay attention to us because we know.
The idea of a particular state cast as savior of the world would be taken to new heights in the United States. But it wasn't an American invention. The savior motif was used as a justification for virtually every imperial intervention during the colonial era. French leaders spoke of a civilizing mission in their new colonies. British leaders spoke of bringing progress and civilized government to India. Imperial Japan spoke of unleashing an earthly paradise in Asia, while the Third Reich dreamt of a worldwide utopia. A decade before World War I, Mark Twain stated that my kind of loyalty was loyalty to one's country, not to its institutions or its office holders. Decades later, George Orwell came to a similar conclusion, that patriotism is a devotion to a certain place and people, contrary to nationalism, which is inseparable from lust for power. This concept of patriotism remains elusive.
Once the war against Saddam begins, we expect every American to support our military, and if they can't do that, to shut up.
Equating super patriotism with militarism, military endeavor, military achievements, military struggles and victories, that's all supposedly a special manifestation of super patriotism. And I argue that a real patriot wants something different for his country. He wants social justice, he wants peace and stability, he wants fairness, he wants an end to racism and sexism. He takes pride in his country's ability at social betterment rather than his country's ability to invade and knock around other countries. A real patriot feels an attachment to his country, but not at the expense of other countries. He or she may feel a special attachment to the history of his own country. He values the accomplishments of his country, like the abolition of slavery, emergence of collective bargaining, and the rights of working people for a better life, the gains made by women in terms of being able to get into public life. These are the kind of things that the real patriot would value.
In October 2001, George W. Bush signed into law what civil libertarians characterized as an all-out assault against the Bill of Rights. It was called the Patriot Act. During the Great War, similar bills were passed. The Espionage Act of 1917 and the Sedition Act, passed a year later, authorized huge fines and lengthy prison terms for anyone who obstructed the military draft or encouraged what was termed disloyalty to the state. The sweeping legislation was quickly put into effect. And first on the list were the Wobblies.
In many ways, the Wobblies were the most impressive example of a union movement in the history of the U.S. working class. Wobblies was the nickname for an organization called the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW, which flourished in the first decade and a half of the 20th century. The American Federation of Labor, which was the main craft union at the time, refused to organize African Americans, immigrants, and women workers. So that meant excluding the vast majority of the working class from the union movement. Along come the Wobblies, and they set out from the beginning specifically to organize immigrants, women, African Americans alongside white workers in what they called one big union. They led some of the most successful strikes. One of their strikes was the first sit-down strike at the time. Women workers played leadership roles, something that was absolutely unheard of at the time. Their philosophy was a revolutionary philosophy. It's known as anarcho-syndicalism.
A federated, decentralized system of free associations incorporating economic as well as social institutions would be what I refer to as anarcho-syndicalism, and it seems to me that it is the appropriate form of social organization for an advanced technological society in which human beings do not have to be forced into the position of tools, of cogs in a machine.
On September 5th, 1917, federal agents raided offices of the Wobblies across the nation, leading to arrests for the offense of causing insubordination, disloyalty, and refusal of duty in the military and naval forces. 101 of the defendants were found guilty and received prison sentences up to 20 years.
Wilson carried out a brutal internal repression called the Red Scare, which is the worst in American history. Far worse than McCarthy, far worse than anything that's going on now. They arrested thousands of people, smashed the labor movement, heavy constraints on free expression, threw lots of people in jail, you know, expelled all sorts of people from the country.
Yet what had started as a hunt against radicals soon spread to every corner of American society. Patriots were encouraged to inform on friends and neighbors who spoke out against the war, while surveillance increased dramatically, not only by the military, but by seemingly benign institutions like the postal system.
The state flourishes in time of war. The state grows stronger in time of war. The state accumulates power. The military is enhanced. The forces of repression are enhanced. War is an opportunity for the government to grow in power.
By the time the war ended, the total number of deaths had reached approximately 9.7 million soldiers, with millions more suffering life-changing injuries and severe post-traumatic stress. To what end was not clear. The massive bloodshed had not made the world safe for freedom and democracy. What it had done was produce enormous fortunes for a handful of corporations and banks, while leaving the worldwide labor movement in disarray. If the Great War had been a test of the Constitution, and the concept of balancing the powers by each other, it failed. The United States Supreme Court, established in Schenck v. United States and Abrams v. United States, that the federal government could suspend constitutional rights when the nation faced, quote, a clear and present danger. Randolph Bourne, speaking of the Great War as a whole, responded preemptively with a now famous dictum. War, he said, is the health of the state.
The definition of polyarchy that we have in the social sciences is a system where the participation of masses of people is limited to voting among one or another representatives of the elite in periodic elections. And in between elections, the masses are now expected to keep quiet, to go back to life as usual, while the elite make the decisions and run the world until they can choose between one or another elite another 4 years later. So really, polyarchy is a system of elite rule, and a system of elite rule which is a little more soft core than the type of elite rule that we would see under a military dictatorship, for instance. But what we see is that under a polyarchy, the basic socioeconomic system does not change. It does not become democratized. Wealth is not redistributed downward. You don't see a more equitable redistribution of wealth and resources. So that's the key. Socioeconomic dictatorship and free elections. That's the prescription for polyarchy. Participatory democracy would see not only more participation of people in the running of their daily affairs, but it would see a democratization of the economy, democratization of social relations.
In the 20th century, you can't really talk openly about rule by the rich. That doesn't sound nice. The devices that have been developed, propaganda devices, are rule by the more competent, the technocratic elite, the responsible people, the educated sectors. There's a huge literature on this, but maybe the primary source for the 20th century is the leading public intellectual of the 20th century in the United States, Walter Lippmann, highly respected commentator on public affairs, also a theorist of democracy.
During World War I, people who later emerged as sort of the founding fathers of modern communication research, modern communication applications, mass media applications, quite a number of them had worked as propagandists during World War I, often as relatively young people who were shaping their own ideas at the time. And one of them was Walter Lippmann, and Lippmann has emerged really to this day as a leading intellectual light of a particular way of looking at society.
Today, Walter Lippmann is known as the Dean of American Journalism. Yet during the Great War, he had been chief leaflet writer and editor of a U.S. propaganda unit. He also served as secretary of the Inquiry, a quasi-intelligence agency. Before dealing with Lippmann's contributions to political theory, we first have to understand the forms of democracy that have characterized the United States and other Western nations since the age of the Great Revolutions. A leap forward from the age of monarchy, the new nation-states would nevertheless preserve the concept that wealthy elites had the right to rule over the mass of the population.